never going to shatter any glass ceilings playing baseball, but I would like to shatter your preconceptions about making coffee at home. I know that was a bit of a stretch. Coffee lovers know that the secret to the best cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans, but there's no way to know when the coffee you get at the grocery store or your local cafe was roasted, which is why Sparkplug Coffee is here to save you from stale, mediocre coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, but the best part is that they guarantee delivery of this outstanding coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Play ball, movie lovers, and thanks so much for lending some time to hear the Next 100 Project, the weekly podcast that does the film reviewing thing. If spoilers make you want to hit baseballs at pitchers' heads, then you need to know we're going to be tossing out lots of spoilers. So don't hit baseballs at our heads, okay? I'm the mule older spouse, Ryan Ellis, and my nag wife is Bev.
That's me.
I'm really both the mule and the nag in this marriage.
It's true. You are a total nag.
And a mule. Okay, the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, A League of Their Own. How many American states are represented in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, meaning the four teams in this movie?
There are three states. Mm-hmm. Illinois, Indiana, and two of the teams are from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. The Rockford Peaches are in Illinois. The Racine Bells are in Wisconsin. The Kenosha, I forget their nickname now, are in Wisconsin also. And South Bend is in Indiana. Nicely done. A little geography there, which is not your best category in Trivial Pursuit.
Uh-uh.
I mixed it up, though. All right, the Next 100 Project's 57th movie-type film, A League of Their Own, was not nominated for the 1998 or 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Columbia Pictures released it 25 years ago on Canada Day, 1992, so that is July 1st for you American and just non-Canadian people. The movie cost about $40 million to make, but raked in over $100 million. Penny Marshall back then, the director, was a hitmaker. So Bev, explain the picture for those who don't remember what it's about with the skinny.
Gina Davis is Dottie and Lori Petty is Kit, two sisters who get recruited by the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, which seeks to keep America's favorite pastime going while all their men are overseas fighting WW2. Their team, the Rockford Peaches, managed by Tom Hanks's acerbic drunk ex-pro ball player Jimmy Dugan, goes up against sexism, poor turnout, and some pretty explosive sibling rivalry between Dottie and Kit.
Or, in a nutshell, women playing baseball? This movie turns me on more than porn. Well, okay, I wasn't actually turned on, but you know what I mean. Mentally turned me on more than porn. Okay, well, some numbers. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 77% only of them liked it, 44 fresh and 13 rotten. And 84% of audiences, so not the greatest scores we've ever seen. The movie was 10th at the 1992 United States box office. Aladdin was numero uno, and Unforgiven, which we covered a couple years ago on the Top 100 Project, was 11th. All right, Bev, a baseball movie, but one directed by a woman, our first woman director in a little while. I like it. I always have. What do you think?
Well, first of all, wasn't our only other woman-directed film also a Penny Marshall film?
No,
we've done big?
Three, because Lost in Translation was Sofia
Coppola.
Oh,
yeah, of course, of course. So, I like this movie a lot. I wouldn't say it's a great movie, but it's funny and charming and very winning, super entertaining. It lays it on a little thick. Penny Marshall could have stood to have a little more faith in her audience, for sure. She is playing to the cheap seats. Regardless, it's impossible to dislike this film. I can't believe that it has as poor a rating on Rotten Tomatoes as it does.
Barely 75%. Most times we review movies, they get 80, 85, and so many we've covered have been in the mid to high 90s. Well, this movie is based on the real league they actually had in the 40s, and I think it went into the 50s, but definitely in the 40s. A lot of the real players are portrayed, although there was no Dottie Hinson. She's based on somebody else. The Hall of Fame sequence at the end shows women who are actually in the league, who are supposed to be the women who are being put in the Hall of Fame. And by the way, they weren't actually inducted into the Hall of Fame. I was just reading about that a week or so ago. There have been women inducted since. They were just honored with a wing in the Hall of Fame, which is still pretty great because not everybody in baseball history gets honored in there at all, unless you are one of the true greats.
It ain't nothing.
One thing that's very untrue, according to the reality, is in the first season, and maybe the whole time, but definitely the first season, they had underhand pitching, so that windmill type. Mm. Now, if you've ever seen somebody do that in person, wow.
Oh,
I don't think I could throw overhand faster than some of the women I've seen throw underhand with that windmill motion.
Have you ever seen Olympic softball?
No, but I can imagine.
Their arms are like moving at the speed of light, and those balls go fast.
And it's not natural to throw it underhand like that. It's not natural to throw a ball overhand, but it's a more natural motion force, even though it's bad on the arm. But I guess they just wanted to do that to get people up to speed about what baseball is, because if people are casual viewers and see that, they might think, oh, this is softball. And I think they actually used softballs in that first season, or maybe many of the seasons in the girls' league back then. But basically, they played real baseball. And I looked up some of the numbers. These may have been inside the park home runs, but there were a few players that had 5, 6, 7 home runs. They didn't play 162 games. Or actually, back then, it would have been 154 games in a season. They played 70 or 80 or something like that. But there were some women who had 6, 7 home runs that led the league. So obviously they hit some balls, maybe right out of the park. Apparently Lori Petty and Rosie O'Donnell were the two best ball players, and they came pretty close to hitting the ball over the fence.
Okay.
And in the sequence where they're in spring training, that is Wrigley Field. So I don't know if they meant at Wrigley Field, for example, that those two actors were coming close to hitting the ball out. But if they could even get it close, I'd be impressed, because I couldn't do that. And I've been playing ball a long time. By the way, the league succeeded from the start, unlike what's portrayed in the film where they struggled to get viewers. TV is what killed it in the early 50s.
Oh, really?
Because people could suddenly see the Cubs if they lived in the West Coast, or they could see the Yankees if they lived in Chicago, or they could see whomever if they lived wherever. Because before, it had to be you go to the ballpark to watch the game, or maybe hear it on the radio. But national television made it so everybody could watch any game they wanted to, and then the women just took a back seat after that.
I guess that makes sense that probably a lot of smaller leagues would have done much better before television, because they would take advantage of these smaller cities that weren't represented by Major League Baseball teams or any sport. I know here in Canada that the Ontario Hockey League, I think they make a tidy living, and it's not actually that cheap to see an Ontario Hockey League game.
It's also Canada, and it's hockey.
Oh, man alive.
We're a little too obsessed with that sport up here.
No kidding.
Another thing that was maybe misportrayed in the film is that Major League Baseball did continue during World War II, even though they lost people like Ted Williams and a lot of the great players. Ted Williams lost 5 years to being a guy who served in the war. Just like Jimmy Stewart in Hollywood was gone for a long time.
You know what, though? Hollywood, you can come back and then act well into your old age. Sure. A lot of actors have proven that. Whereas with baseball, you have a really limited time that you can have a career. And, of course, going to war, not only do you risk death, but you risk a great deal of injury.
Mm-hmm. And Ted Williams lost so many years to his career, and he's still one of the greatest players ever. He might have been the greatest player ever if he hadn't lost all that time. But Major League Baseball just went on with shittier players. There's one guy who got to play with one arm, and apparently he was pretty good.
Really?
But he never would have been playing in Major League Baseball.
Like, he went up to bat with one arm?
There was a ball player in the 90s named Jim Abbott who pitched with one hand. He'd been doing it probably millions of times in his life, throwing a ball and then catching a ball. Because the whole thing was, oh, well, bunt on the guy. He can't field. Okay, what would happen is he'd throw the ball with his left hand. He'd pitch it. And then as soon as he let it go, he'd have a left-handed glove in his right arm. He would make this motion instantaneously. Then the glove's on the pitching hand, and when he picked the ball up, he could get out of there and he could throw, and he never seemed to bumble it.
How could he throw once he caught the ball?
I haven't seen him play in a long time. He's been retired for many years. But he would just re-exchange, and then the ball would be in his left hand, and the glove would be back in the crook of his right arm.
And just through the muscle memory, he was that fast.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
But he did it so many times in his life. He actually threw a no-hitter once. Now, this is in the 90s. They didn't have to let him play. It wasn't like it was the war and they needed either some kind of stunt to get people to come out or just bodies to play the game. So every once in a while, a guy goes above and beyond, but there's a one-armed guy in the history of the game who wouldn't have played except for the fact that they needed players. But anyway, back to the movie and back to the whole girls' baseball league. Another thing actually that's untrue is that Racine did play in the World Series, but they played Kenosha in the 1943 series. Rockford finished last in the four-team league. Now, I talked about geography, and I found this interesting because I'd never looked this up until we were watching the movie. I want to see where those four cities are in relation to each other. Obviously, we know that South Bend and some of the other places are in the Midwest, so I had to look up where all these places are. The furthest drive between two of those four teams would be Racine to South Bend, and that's only 3 hours. So when you hear Dottie say at the end about driving all night, they never need to drive all night. They would have had to drive in the late evening maybe to get to a game, but they would have been driving all night. It was all, at that point at least, very localized. One thing that's very true, though, when you see injuries, bruises, that big strawberry bruise on the girl's leg, apparently they were all real. When they got hurt, they just filmed it. Although the filth on their faces, I've been playing ball a long time. That is not accurate.
Yeah.
You don't get that dirty playing ball. Maybe one person would, but not everybody would be covered in soot. As for the players themselves, I think they're pretty believable for the most part, especially Geena Davis, who wasn't in the original cast. She joined almost at the last minute and picked up the game extremely fast, but then she almost did qualify for the archery team at the Olympics, I think back in the 90s or something. That's pretty impressive for an actress to be that good in anything athletically, so to almost get to the Olympics.
Yeah, she's clearly an athlete. The part was supposed to go to Demi Moore, who apparently was also like a really natural baseball player. Penny Marshall said that she was great. She would have looked amazing. They were confident with her. But then she got pregnant shortly before they were going to go into shooting, which is why at the last minute they had to replace her with Geena Davis. And I was watching this interview with Penny Marshall, and she goes, yeah, Bruce Willis literally screwed Demi out of that part.
I was reading Deborah Winger had the part.
Really?
Winger is a lot smaller than Geena Davis. One thing that really works, especially in the scene where she grabs the baseball that Rosie O'Donnell throws at her, is the fact that she's already a towering presence and just snatches that ball out of the air. Deborah Winger's not particularly big. Maybe it wouldn't have been quite as effective, and maybe she couldn't have done that in the first place. I don't know how they did that, actually. Maybe they just threw it at her and made it look like it was faster than it was.
If we watch it closely with editing, I'm sure that it's just a trick of editing it quickly and then putting a good sound effect to make it sound like it was going
well. Well, I'll tell you, as somebody who's been playing the game a long time, I've caught balls with my bare hand many times. It's not that hard, really, to do. It isn't.
I believe you. I cannot dispute anything you say about baseball.
Well, about Geena Davis, we've covered her on Tootsie and the Top Runner Project, and then, of course, Thelma Louise last year and the Next Runner Project. She's got the charisma and the athleticism, but she's also a badass, partly because she's so much bigger than everybody else. She was at her peak at this time because she had done Thelma and Louise, and she won the Oscar a few years before that in The Accidental Tourist. But then she started making movies with the guy she married, Rennie Harlan, including Cutthroat Island. I don't know if she just wanted to lay low as she got a little older. Maybe Hollywood wouldn't cast her because she got to be older, and that almost always seems to be the death knell, unless you're Meryl Streep, maybe Susan Sarandon. But Cutthroat Island seemed to have been the one that ruined her, and it's too bad because she'd been so great so many times in the early 90s and into the mid-90s. But we've barely seen her since Stuart Little in 1999 on screen, apart from that TV show she did.
Here, I have a question. Did Cutthroat Island ruin Rennie Harlan's career?
It didn't help.
But he still had a decent career afterwards?
Well, Deep Blue Sea is the only movie I can think of that he made after that was in any way a success. I don't think it was even a big success. This is the guy that did Die Hard 2, which is a pretty good success, and he was getting to be a bit of a star, I thought. Cliffhanger as well. So oh, yeah. It didn't help either of them, actually. This was a woman who was near the top of the field for actresses in the business and then was kind
of
gone.
Lots of actors and actresses have bad movies in their career and it doesn't destroy them.
Including the top billed Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
He was coming off of dud after dud after dud. Bonfire of the Vanities definitely highlights that a few years before this. And some other films he did that no one seemed to care about. I think Turner and Hooch is better remembered now than it was actually received back then, for example. But here is a movie he gets into, big hit, and he was back. We covered him in Forrest Gump, Toy Story, Saving Private Ryan. The character is based on baseball players Jimmy Fox and Hack Wilson. This career resurrection performance included a lot of gnashed teeth acting and some gravel in his voice. This is maybe the most acting Tom Hanks has done, where you really see the strings, I thought, more than most. He's still Tom Hanks. He's one of my favorite actors ever. But he was pouring on a little bit too much at times, I thought.
Yeah, he's almost vaudevillian in his drunk act. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of overkill, but everything in this movie is a little bit overkill, so you can hardly blame him. It's just kind of the tone of the film. He's still, even though he's playing almost a bad guy, he's certainly a mean guy. He's a bully for the first half of his performance, but he's Tom Hanks, so he's the most charming, charismatic man in the world, and it's simply impossible to dislike him.
That wasn't thought of back then, I don't think. It took a few more years before he started.
I'm sure Penny Marshall realized that.
And she was the director of his previous, maybe not the last big hit he had, but one of the last big hits he had, and that was Big.
Which was a better movie than League of Their Own, in my opinion.
Okay. I find it interesting that he had a yo-yo diet, and he apparently has type 2 diabetes now, and it kind of started around this point. She made him gain weight for this performance so he could look like an out-of-touch, older, going to seed kind of... He doesn't look that fat, does he?
No, he doesn't look fat at
all. But they talk about how she wanted him to eat and eat and eat, and Rosie O'Donnell to eat less and less and less. But then the very next year, he's in Philadelphia, and he's playing the AIDS victim, where he's got to lose weight. And then he did movies like Castaway, where he's both fat and skinny in the same movie. They took that time off, I think people know that story. But this is a guy that's done the De Niro thing where he's gained weight for roles, lost weight for roles. And yeah, you're right. It doesn't really look like he's quite as out of shape as he probably should be.
Well, he's like a trim dude. I think he was just always such a skinny guy. He probably is just one of those people with really naturally fast metabolism that has to eat a lot to gain weight.
We're talking about looks here. The players really did have to go to beauty school in the AAGPBL. Am I doing that right? I think so.
All American Girls Professional Baseball League.
Okay, yes. And I think the comparison would be how major league players now have to learn the media. One of the things they must all have to go through, and in Bull Durham, which is a movie we'll probably cover next year in this exact same week because it'll be the 30-year anniversary of that film, there's that point where Costner teaches Robbins his cliches, the things he's going to say to the media. Well, you got to go to beauty school in the girls' baseball league, and for so long now, these players have had to learn how to talk to the media and not say anything. Answer questions, but don't actually say anything. Derek Jeter is probably the best we've ever seen at that.
I like how a lot of the women, it just comes naturally to them. One of them is a beauty queen, right? Mm-hmm. And then some of the women could care less and genuinely are starting from zero.
Marla Hooch.
Yeah.
What do you recommend? A lot of night games.
When they show her in the press materials and she's just shot from way far away.
What a hitter. This was Megan Kavanaugh's debut as Marla. I thought she was pretty good.
Yeah, I agree.
She's only in about half of it, or maybe just past the halfway point when she gets married and goes off to be with Nelson after singing that song in the bar with him. Or to him, I should say.
The one I love.
I love the little story with Marla and her father.
You know, one of the things the film does really well is these women persistently come across like real people, believable people. They do things that I just believe women would do. It's so easy to just make a rah-rah root for them movie, but there's an authenticity to the way that they react to the attention, and there's an authenticity to a relationship between a daughter and a father where he just believes in her, and they don't feel like caricatures. Even though, like I said, the movie overkills a lot of things, but I don't know, there was something refreshing about those two.
It was a lovely little sequence when she's going off and he's going to stay behind. It's only about maybe 2 minutes of the whole movie, but it's very emotional and very touching stuff, I thought.
And he says, if she was a man, I'd be talking to the Yankees. Mm-hmm. He just believes in her so much.
And I like the Maggio.
He doesn't, yes. And he doesn't want her to look any different or be any different than the way she is. He just loves her the way she is.
Just like Nelson obviously does.
Yeah, which is like a big theme in the film.
She's a little better looking at that point, though, because Madonna, May, has made her look a little better.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they all have, but Madonna's trying to teach the one who can't read how to read, too. So,
oh, yeah, that's right.
They're all helping each other out. Well, one thing about the film, we'll get to the ending in a few minutes, but I'll just say this part right now. The fact that the Rockford Peaches lose probably their best hitter in Marla about midway through the season, they lose their best player in Dottie for most of the World Series. She only plays in that last game. And they trade Kit. The idea that they even make the World Series after all those losses, especially winning the World Series. Sorry, they don't win it, but get as far as the seventh game of the World Series seems a little bit bogus when they lose their best player, their best pitcher, and their best hitter.
Yeah, although, is it implied that Kit is actually one of their best players?
Best pitcher.
Best pitcher, okay, that's fair.
We hear that Betty Spaghetti is a pitcher, but we never see it happen, I don't recall. Well, maybe in the montages, because this is a sports movie, a lot of montages. But then it's Ellen Sue's pitching through most of the late games, well, the playoff games, the World Series games, when Kit has been traded. But that is weird that she gets traded up for the World Series. But this is a fledgling brand new league, so I guess all bets are off. And that may not have been accurate. Maybe the writers Lowell Ganz and Babalu Mandel didn't base that on anything real. Probably didn't, actually. Ganz and Mandel have written two movies that are better than this one, I think. And funnier than this one. Not that this one isn't funny. But they co-wrote a lot of things, including some Happy Days stuff. I think that's where they got their start, way back in the 70s. But Parenthood and City Slickers. Parenthood's a movie I've liked more and more every time I've seen it.
Yeah.
Great comedy, great truth in it as well. Terrific cast. City Slickers is very funny. I guess they wrote this scene, the 53-second pee, when Tom Hanks stumbles in when he first gets introduced to the girls. Takes that long piss. That was some good peeing. I like how that's the introduction. Well, no, we do see him earlier because he gets hired by Walter Harvey, which is a stand-in for Charles Wrigley, the guy who actually owned Wrigley Field and then had Wrigley gum. What do you think about the comedy? The film's a drama through a lot of it, especially in the World Series, but also very funny.
Well, I mean, like, every comedy has some dramatic arc that it has to have to make it a coherent film. You know, it's not the funniest movie in the world.
The most comedy sequences belong to Hanks, including, of course, there's no crying in baseball.
You have him, and you have Rosie O'Donnell and Madonna to some extent. Mm-hmm. But it is definitely the tone of the film. Like, it is supposed to be silly and fun. You are supposed to really enjoy yourself. And he is hysterical when he's trying to be. No crying in baseball. And it's awful. He's bullying her, but it is actually hysterical when you watch it.
Well, the way she cries is funny. She's a funny crier, that actress.
He's so confounded by her.
Well, thank God there's no love story between Dottie and Jimmy, because it does look like it's going that way.
Oh, yeah.
Even if at the very end is old people, but then he's died before she manages to see him at the Hall of Fame induction ceremony.
But again, it just feels like a better film because they came to each other as friends and they earned respect for one another. Mm. I mean, they're both coming with deficits where he's a drunk that doesn't seem to give a damn about his job, and she's a woman that he has no faith in to begin with because, you know, it's the 40s. Through the course of the film, they just learn to respect each other's opinions and their competence, and it's so much more real and heartwarming because there is no romance between them.
His alcoholism is cured by a caring friend with a bottle of pop.
Well.
You notice that? I just watched Logan. Great movie. But one thing about the film, I'll say, this isn't even a spoiler. He's a drunk through the first, I don't know, half hour, 45 minutes of the film. I don't think he drinks at all in the last bit of the film. And it's not like when he's on the run that they don't have any time for him to drink. So it's almost like they forget that this is a guy who's got a real serious problem. Jimmy's the same. He's been a drunk for so much of this, and then suddenly, because he's inspired now, he's able to conquer something that's overtaken him, and probably for many years.
When it stops being convenient for the plot. I've considered very unlikely that he's not still drinking. He's just not getting fall down drunk during a game.
Okay, true, yeah. I do like the way he finally conquers his lushdom, even though he's probably still drunk. What are you, stupid? You're going to bump with a best hitter? And then she calls him a lush, and he starts being a manager. It's a little abrupt, but then you get the feeling this is a guy who loves baseball. He maybe doesn't want to manage girls. He doesn't want to manage the girls until towards the end of the film. That's a pretty nice progression. He starts to actually care about them and respect them. The whole
thing. To the point where he's offered a better job, and he's like, no, I'll stay here.
Yeah, I've already got a job. But I love that moment in one of the montages where he hands the chewing tobacco to Dottie and says, a lot of ball players use it. If he wasn't already on board with these people, especially her, then he was.
Mm-hmm. What he says over and over, he says it to Dottie when she talks about leaving the team. He respects her passion for baseball. Like, that's a big part of it, that these girls are passionate and they're competitive and it makes them feel good. It gives them confidence because they are really good at it. He sees that. He sees that passion and he sees that in himself, so he can relate to that. And that's why he just cannot wrap his head around why Dottie would ever want to leave the sport, why she would choose marriage and a family over baseball. And to be honest, I don't think the movie really makes a good enough case for it. For her leaving the league.
You don't get the feeling that Bob Henson would insist that she not play anymore. He doesn't seem like that kind of guy. And Bill Pullman's got that tiny little role. He seems like he's a caring husband. That's my wife! When she hits the hit that gives them the lead briefly in the World Series.
But we don't see what would happen if she said to him, you know what, I think I'd like to play baseball for a few more years and just go on the road and live in this totally different city rather than live with you and have our marriage and work for the dairy together. We don't see the scene where they have that conversation. It's absurd that she leaves the league in the middle of the season during the World Series. He can't just hang on for a few more weeks.
Probably a week.
Yeah, exactly. That's definitely pushing it a little bit, but I don't think it's pushing it to say that a husband in the 40s come home from war and insist that his wife just come home with him and have the authority and, just for lack of a better word, the privilege to say to his wife, you're coming back to Oregon.
Yeah.
Forget about it.
Kit and many other girls didn't have that thing to tie them down. We even see Doris with her whole thing about the dude back in New York who didn't treat her well. Bye-bye, whatever his name is. She rips up the pitcher and throws it out the window. So she's obviously very free after that moment. And Kit has nothing tying her down. May has nothing tying her down. She even has one of Madonna's best acting moments maybe in her whole career. You tell Mr. Chuck about, I ain't going back to doing that. Dancing for guys and all that kind of stuff. Madonna was apparently a prima donna on this set. And she didn't like making the movie. But she's fine. She's not great, but she's okay. She didn't stand out as anything bad in the movie. She seems like a decent athlete.
I think she's great. I actually love her in the movie. I forgot how much I liked her in this movie, that she steals scenes. I mean, the dancing scene especially. She's amazing. She's a great dancer. Of course, she's a great dancer. Yeah.
That's a fun little sequence.
You can't take your eyes off of her.
Yeah, especially in that sequence. Well, she went on to do Body of Evidence the year after this, the sex movie, which wasn't very good, and Evita, which is maybe her best-known acting performance. But I think this is the best work she ever did in this film. She didn't want to sing on set because there's a lot of downtime in a movie like this, and apparently the actors would entertain the extras who played the fans in the crowd and just entertain themselves, but she wouldn't sing. They sang her songs, but she wouldn't. I don't know if she actually acted badly to the other actors in the movie, but she wrote a letter to her friend where she was ripping on all of them. Although she and Rosie O'Donnell made friends, and I think they still are friends after all this time, 25 years later.
They have great natural chemistry.
And they're so different as well. Apparently Rosie O'Donnell's character was supposed to be just like May. But then they found her and thought she can be funny instead. Or very intense, too, in the last game, in the last inning of the World Series. One more! One more! Thank you, God!
I really love her in the movie. Both her and Madonna have these huge personas now. It's really hard to divorce from that and just see them as characters in the film, but back in the early 90s, when they weren't nobodies by any means, but they could get away from those personas enough to make these movies, especially Rosie O'Donnell.
Well, this was her debut, so I don't know what she did before this. Maybe she was a stand-up comic, but this was her movie.
Yeah, she was a stand-up comic.
This was her movie debut.
I don't remember. I feel like I knew who she was when I saw this movie, but, you know, I was 10, so... Mm-hmm. No, sorry, I was 14 when it came out.
Well, Rosie didn't keep having a movie career. She's only been in two movies in the past 20 years. She's been doing The View for most of the last...
Well, she had her own show, her own daytime talk show for many years. She was Ellen before there was Ellen.
Yeah, true, right.
a show like that with a live studio audience was so much like a late night talk show, but daytime format.
Chelsea Handler had that show. I don't think she even does it anymore, does she?
No. Well, she has a Netflix show now.
And Schumer would get one if she wanted one. Schumer has the other show.
A lot of actresses.
Schumer has the sketch show she does.
Yeah, a lot of women could get one if they wanted one.
Is that true?
You don't think they would give Tina Fey her own show if she wanted it, or Amy Poehler, or Kristen
I'm not saying they shouldn't get them. I'm
Melissa
just saying.
McCarthy, a lot of these women.
Okay, those names, yeah. I hope so. There should be more of them than there are. Meaning there should be more women-driven shows than there are.
Well, speaking of women-driven, maybe we should talk about feminism in League of Their Own.
Definitely passes the Bechdel test, doesn't it?
It passes the Bechdel test in the very first scene. The very first scene is a mother and daughter talking about whether or not she should go to this Hall of Fame induction thing. And very much like a woman, insisting that nothing she did back then was important. Penny Marshall and the screenwriters, they really nailed that way that women cannot see themselves making a difference. The way that I'm sure very good male ball players have no trouble seeing where they fit in the world and considering what they do quintessentially American and important in history.
Well, speaking of history and speaking of women who were not given enough credit for their abilities, it may be brief, but there's that nice moment with the black woman who picks up the ball and can throw it over Dottie's head and hurt the hand of Ellen Sue. She throws it so far.
It's
the Jackie Robinson moment.
I'm glad that they did it, because it's certainly an important thing to address. Oh, hey, well, all these nice white women got their chance. There was still a whole other group that was being completely excluded. If they had let black women play, chances are most of them would not have been there. The same way that black players and Latina players replaced white players to a great extent in Major League everything. Yeah, because they're just better athletes. And the moment was good that they included it, but it was also, like, kind of embarrassingly on the nose. Throws the ball, nod. Okay, moving on. Back to the story.
Well, that's the only moment you see anything like that happen in the film. It's not like there's any payoff or anything like that. It may have been a shoehorned moment, but I still liked it. I thought it was a nice little touch.
I'm glad they didn't. Honestly, and I'm not proud to admit this, I don't think I would have even crossed my mind watching the film.
Most people probably agree with
that. Which is awful. This day and age, it absolutely should have, and it kind of shamed me when I saw that. Remember, stupid, this great story of these underdogs, they weren't even really the underdogs in this story.
Well, the reason the girls are playing this at all is because it is World War II, the men are off serving, and let's not forget this is a war movie in that way, and there is then the intensity of the death letter scene, where maybe you don't think it's going to be Dottie's husband. It is built up that it would be, though, and then it ends up being Betty's husband instead. Tracy Reiner, who is Penny Marshall and Rob Reiner's daughter, I think is the unsung hero of this cast. She's always the peacemaker, she's the one who's always trying to be nice to everybody, she's trying to help everybody out. And when she realizes it's her husband, George, she had the baseball card that she wanted Tom Hanks to sign. He rips it up in the scene where he does the long pee. I think it was played pretty well by her and by Penny Marshall directing it and by all the actors. Hanks, too. Very sweet moment for him.
I disagree. Really? I mean, I think it's a good scene, but I think that they drag it on way too long. Considering he's a hero for just taking the telegraph out of the messenger's hand, kicking him out and being like, we're not going to wait to find out who died. And then drawing the scene out for another 2 minutes.
That's not 2 minutes.
He reads it and
Come on.
Just slowly death marches over
it's
in their general direction.
45 seconds to a minute.
Whatever. He could have just said the name. He could have just been like, oh, Betty, I'm so sorry.
Well, then blame that on Penny Marshall, then.
I do, too. I'm not blaming him. It's noticeable because the initial point of the scene is to not drag it out. And then they drag it out.
Well, considering Dottie's been worried the whole time about her husband, it's an important moment for her. And then, of course, he shows up that night. That's also a movie touch, I suppose, that he just happens to be there the night she's weeping. Oh my God, it's you!
How quickly did he get to, where are they, Illinois at that point? Or are they in Wisconsin?
Well, they're always in that area.
They're in the boarding house, so yeah. Did he get in a car and drive to Illinois? I guess he did.
They may have flown him to that area rather than back home to Oregon.
But he does have a car to take her home, so.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's one of those things, and online people do it all the time. We've done it plenty of times. Why did this happen? Reasonably good questions come up a lot of the time. I guess that's one.
Because it makes a better scene. Makes more drama.
All right, let's talk about the ending of the World Series and Kit's big payoff. We barely talked about Lori Petty, who was in Point Break the year before this. Not the greatest actress of all time. I thought she was fine in the role. As I said, a pretty good ball player. Moira Kelly could have had the role instead. She was the girl in the skating movie, what was it called again, with D.B. Sweeney, The Cutting Edge. So Lori Petty, in the beginning of the film, likes the high ones. So the movie must end with her hitting a high one. And she does, for the inside the park home run. And on that last play, there's redemption for several different people. Evelyn in right field, the one who gets chewed out for missing the cutoff man, and that's where the whole no crying at baseball comes from. But then she hits the cutoff woman, in that last sequence. Yes! Kit, of course, has the not only the winning hit, but also hits the high fastball that she couldn't hit before. And even Dottie, in a way, because, yeah, she drops the ball. It's arguable that she does it on purpose. I don't think she does. But then when they show Kit celebrating with her team, they cut to that shot of Geena Davis and Tom Hanks standing there. Hank's just looking nonplussed about it. But Geena Davis just slightly smiles because she's proud of her sister for having come through. So there's a redemption for her. And Kit can forgive, but only once she gets to be the hero and wins the game. Then it's okay with her and Dottie at the end.
You know, I don't blame her for having this merciless sibling rivalry with Dottie. Dottie can do nothing to...
Miss Perfect.
Yeah, she is Miss Perfect. This is the thing, is Kit, she can't win against this girl. Everything Dottie does is perfect. She's prettier, she's taller, she's a better athlete, she's got a husband, she's just doing everything right. So I can imagine how it would be just intolerable to be her sister.
Except Kit herself was pretty good, and like Dottie says, I didn't get you in the league, you get yourself in the league. I got you on the train. Kit's pretty good too, and I guess at the end she finally realizes that she is. I mean, she is the one who had the winning hit, and their team won the World Series. And when Kit says to her sister about dragging the bus and all the heat, the doubleheaders, you think I'm going to miss that? Yeah! And every time I've seen this movie, I'm nodding with her. I completely agree. That's why you do stuff like this.
So why don't you go? Well, I know why she went. She says to Jimmy, have you ever been married? And I like that notion because he's like, why would you want to leave this? Have you ever been married? And it's a great example of how the personal is political. She has to give up her career because in order to have a happy personal life, she just has to accept the roles that are assigned a woman in the 40s.
You know, it's funny. You actually hear it, and it probably was some kind of post-production dub, but Marla says when she's getting married and driving away and they're all throwing the baseballs wrapped in the socks at the car, you hear Marla say, I'll see you next season, suggesting that her husband's going to let her play, but then at least he must live in the area because they saw him at a nightclub. So obviously he doesn't live in Oregon, he lives somewhere in either Illinois, Wisconsin, or Indiana, wherever they were in that sequence of the nightclub.
And between her and also the flirtatious brothers that are crazy about Doris, these are men that fell in love with baseball players.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas that's not the case with Dottie. He fell in love with a milkmaid.
Yeah.
So that's just not what he was expecting.
That's not what he signed up for.
Not what he signed up for, thank you, yeah.
I'm reminded at the end that the movie is one long flashback.
I saw the movie enough times when I was younger, and I remembered a fair amount about it, but man, my memory just blanked on all of the bookend scenes of her as an older woman, everything at the Hall of Fame. That stuff is so pointless. I wish they would have taken it out.
Yeah, you might be right. It might not be that necessary, but it's nice. It's got some emotional stuff in it, I suppose.
Ugh. They have to have everybody. They have to have the chubby kid who's like, you're gonna
Stillwell Angel, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I thought there was an okay payoff with him. Well, David Strathairn runs the league. We did him in LA Confidential only a few months ago. He's got a small part in that and a relatively small part in this. I mean, he's a supporting player. He's the second male lead behind Tom Hanks, really. But the other actor, not actress, but actor in this movie that's fantastic, one of the greatest cameos in movie history, is John Lovitz.
As I said to you when we were watching the movie, oh my God, remember when John Lovitz was funny? He's so funny!
Every line he speaks is funny.
Oh, everything he does, he's hysterical. The fact that he leaves and goes away forever is a tragedy.
Well, I guess they cut his role down because they wanted to just get his best bits in. And then what a great example of making everything he says funny, including his last line. I hate when they get attached to me like that.
Oh, I loved him.
And he is played out at the end as being the scout at the end, too. And even Marla has that little payoff with him because he didn't want to take her because she's not good enough looking. And you see the actress playing the older Marla saying, remember, honey, that's when you got me in the league or you found me or whatever it was. Because I didn't realize that until I saw it a few years ago and realized, oh, that's Marla as the older woman. And, of course, he's got the stogie. And that's the payoff. So you recognize who he is, just like Strathairn, the older version of Strathairn, puts on the glasses to know, you know who he is. Taya Leone is the first baseman for a scene, at least in the World Series she is. Janet Jones is in the film, too. I think she's on Racine, meaning Wayne Gretzky's wife, Janet Jones.
Oh, I was wondering what he said. I was like, I don't know any Janet Jones except for Wayne Gretzky's wife.
Right, that's her. She was an actress back then, let's not forget. And David Lander, who was Squiggy, Penny Marshall, of course, was in Laverne and Shirley.
Oh, right, of course.
And he is the voiceover for Racine. I have seen enough to know I have seen too much. Harry Shearer, who was just getting to be a bigger player on the scenes because of The Simpsons in the early 90s, is the newsreel guy in the beginning where he's describing why they have a girls' professional baseball league.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm. And Penny Marshall, who will be 74 in October, she hasn't made very many movies in her life, only 7 in total, but 4 of those were hits. And A League of Their Own is her second, adjusted for inflation. Big is her number one, not surprisingly, adjusted for inflation. But a couple years before A League of Their Own, she did Awakenings, which got a Best Picture nomination and a nomination for De Niro. So right at that time, she was at her peak. And I guess because she's a woman is why she didn't get to do better projects. Or maybe whatever followed this, I forget what it is off the top of my head, sunk her. If she did one bad movie, maybe that was the end of it for her.
Well, like I said about Gina Davis, it seems like they give more second chances to men than women. It seems like it's a lot easier to get sunk.
The last movie that I think Penny Marshall directed was Riding in Cars with Boys, which was not a great film, but a pretty good dramatic film. Steve Zahn was surprisingly good in that, in a very dramatic role, and Drew Barrymore for that matter.
I was curious about that. I looked it up. It didn't even make its budget back. Because I was wondering, like, why didn't she work more? And there was that, and then the movie she made before Riding Cars with Boys, and I don't remember what it was now, also didn't make its budget back.
So it may have been politics, but it may have also been the fact that she would have been getting close to 60. And maybe a lot of people, even in the film business, unlike Ridley Scott, who's now saying, I'm going to make 500 Alien sequels, even though he's 80 this year. But somebody like Penny Marshall maybe just says, I'm retirement age, I want to retire, even though it's film and people don't retire until they die, usually. Michael Caine is 83 or something, and he's talking about having cancer. That guy's been acting 4 or 5 movies a year. Yeah. Not everybody wants to be Michael Caine or Ridley Scott. Maybe she just said, I've had enough, I'm going to quit.
I think that for a lot of people, for a lot of women, and for a lot of people who just aren't white men, there's a lot more discouragements than just, I don't want to work anymore. I think she probably had to butt her head up against a lot more bullshit than Michael Caine ever had to in his career. After he reached a certain amount of success, there's probably projects that lined up at his door for him, and it's a lot easier to say, to hell with it, I'm going to retire, when no matter how much success you have, you still have to fight for every
project. But it doesn't have to be political. I'm just saying that somebody who does get to be in her 60s, maybe a combination of the two, that she had enough problems and then said, I don't mind just coasting on the money I've made on Big, A League of Their Own, or Awakenings, and so on.
Maybe like the film where people paid tickets to see a game just so they could literally get drunk and say, girls can't play baseball! Maybe somebody was hanging out around here saying, girls can't make movies!
Great payoff, though, and that guy's doing that in the first game, and Ellen Sue, the shortstop, wings him with a ball and knocks him over, just like Stillwell Angel gets the glove thrown in his face. Ha-ha! Got him!
It is a great example of what I was talking about when I say some things were just laid on way too thick, and that was definitely one of those things.
Well, like we said when we were watching the film, why would somebody pay anything? It wouldn't have been that expensive, a ticket in the 40s, but why would you pay any money at all to go in and just hack on something?
Just to heckle the player.
I guess maybe that's what people do now. The modern trolls might do that, but then why would you go to a ball game now and pay the many dollars you'd have to pay if you're just going to take a big dump on it? Marshall's writers were Gans and Mandel. I mentioned them already. They based this on a story by Kim Wilson and Kelly Kandel. Kelly Kandel's brother, Casey, played for the Houston Astros back when I first became a baseball fan. I remember that name quite well. The producers were Robert Greenhut, Woody Allen's guy, and Elliot Abbott, along with some other people. A lot of men, though, behind the scenes. I guess that's pretty typical, though. If a woman was going to be a director, she probably wasn't going to have a woman writer and a woman producer. The movie's 2-3-5-1. We watched the DVD, which looks not too shabby. The cinematographer shooting that DVD, well, not the DVD, but anyway, Miroslav Ondrasek, who was, I think maybe even past this movie, but certainly in the early part of his career, Miloš Forman's guy, because he shot Ragtime and Amadeus. Amadeus has been covered by us. And then he became a Penny Marshall guy as well. So, interesting dichotomy of directors to work with Miloš Forman and Penny Marshall, two very different people. The editors were Adam Bernardi and George Bowers. And as I said, sports in movies equals montages. Plus wipes. You don't see a lot of wipes we've been watching.
Yeah, there was wipes.
Yeah. Almost seems like college productions to show wipes. Or Star Wars, I guess. Or Kurosawa, for that matter. One of the greats of all time. And the music was Hans Zimmer. He did Thelma Louise the year before this, of course, with Gina Davis. He's now better known for the Batman movies, the Christopher Nolan ones, and the Bwah sound effect that's been in so many movies, or at least trailers. And you're not really a fan of music a lot of the time, but what did you think of him and what did you think of the editing, which is, of course, your thing?
Well, I honestly will criticize the editing. I did not like the open and closing scenes at all. Mm. If it were up to me, I would have cut them all together. Scenes like the revelation of which soldier's name was on that telegram.
That's Penny Marshall, it's not the editing.
Okay, fine. But it was an editing choice, one way or the other. It's always hard to say whether it's a cinematographer or an editor, whether it was their choice or the director's choice. The baseball sequences are great. It doesn't hurt that the girls seem like genuinely believable players, and the montages are just fine. Mm. I'm not heavily criticizing it. It's definitely a well-paced film.
And it is a little over 2 hours, too, which is pretty long for a sports film.
Not that long if you just took out those bookends. Especially the ending. Oh my god, the ending goes on way too long.
I guess they wanted to show that the women were honored at the Hall of Fame, but you could have done that with a simple graphic at the end, too.
and had a bunch of actors being like, is that you? Is that you? Oh my god, Doris. Oh my god, Marla.
I guess the other thing too is that you've got the whole payoff with her and Kit as if they've made up, but then they make up in the movie. They don't need to make up at the end of the movie too.
Yeah, and they're making up is just like, hey, it's you, and they hug.
I haven't seen you in a while, which happens in life.
Exactly. It actually seemed really disappointing. There was nothing to it.
Okay, the influencers, not that much from this film. They had the TV series in April 1993, so a year after the movie came out. It didn't last long. Only 5 of the 6 episodes they shot even made it to air. There's No Crying in Baseball has been imitated and adapted countless times.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of the great quotes, and it made the quotes list. It was 54th in the top 100 quotes. And apparently Rogers Hornsby, who's referencing that quote, my manager said I was a whatever, 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 and my parents came all the way down to see me watch that game. And Rogers Hornsby, apparently the real ball player, great for the Cubs and Cardinals back in the 20s, 30s, and so on. Hall of Famer, outstanding ball player. When he got to be in coaching, managing, whatever it was, he was tough. And I read online that where that No Crying in Baseball thing comes from, Ron Santo, who was a Hall of Famer for the Cubs, he may have been young at that point, just breaking into the game. And apparently when Hornsby said something to somebody else, Santo said, if he says that to me, I'll cry. So that's where they get that line from. But it is one of the great quotes. Even though, as you say, it's very mean, but it's very funny. Because of the way the actress cries out, too. I didn't mean to do that.
It's painfully true about women that if I was getting that kind of a taking down from a boss, I would probably cry, too.
Well, as a guy who's been a captain of many teams for a long time, I've thought some of those same things, but I don't think I've ever said them. I hope I've never said anything like that. I don't think I have. And no one ever made me feel like I wanted to cry, a manager or a coach. I guess I've been the manager or the coach for so long, I have to make myself cry.
It's because boys don't cry. Boys lose their temper. Girls cry.
You're still throwing to the wrong base. That's something I want you to work on for next season. His head wants to explode. All right, so the movie was nominated for no Oscars. I thought maybe Gina Davis for Best Actress could have been nominated. Hanks for Supporting Actress, certainly. Possibly the screenplay, and certainly, even though he didn't seem to like it when he was playing the end credits, the song. This Used to Be My Playground by Madonna is the kind of song the Oscars loves.
I hated it then, I hate it now. Pretty cool. I don't think it's like really appropriate for the film.
It's so somber, too. It's almost like this lost sort of thing. And I guess the league was lost. It didn't last that long.
Yeah, but that's not what the movie's about.
The movie's joyous about the fact that he's ever had this experience at all.
It's about the beginning of the league. It goes on for 10 more years. You could say that to the girls that played in the first season, they probably had full careers as much as they could have possibly wanted or expected out of that league before the league fell apart. So I feel like it's completely inappropriate.
And if they played 5 to 10 seasons, that's as much as most men have ever gotten in professional sports.
It's my guess, and I'm completely pulling this out of my butt. Madonna had that song written, and maybe it was going to be a B-side, an album, or something like that. And then they said, hey, Madonna, do you have a song we can use for the film?
Hair.
Probably had like a few they could have chosen from, and that was the only one that was remotely appropriate. So they recorded it and released it. She was so huge at the time that just about anything she did associated with a hit movie was going to be a hit.
A League of Their Own made the National Film Registry in 2012, so only 20 years. That's not bad. A Christmas Story went in that same year. Also, Dirty Harry and The Matrix. What a foursome that is.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nominated for the Top 100 Cheers, the Top 100 Genres in the Sports category. I'm a little bit surprised that the Playground song didn't get nominated for the songs. I'm not saying it's a great song, but I know the AFI, and I know the Oscars, and I think in both cases, it's a surprise that they weren't at least nominating the song. Okay, that wraps it up. Baseball started yesterday. Major League Baseball's going all over again. So we had to do a baseball movie. I'm a fan of this one. It's not my favorite baseball movie, but it's one I've seen many times. The ending, by the way, there's no crying at baseball, but when Kit succeeds, everyone loves her and she has that redemption. It almost makes me cry every time I see it.
It's very almost.
Sweet. It's very sweet, especially when you see Gina Davis happy for her, that little smile on her face. I mean, she got bowled over by her seconds before, and if she's happy for her sister. I like this movie quite a lot.
Aww.
What about you?
I don't care as much about the baseball. Not that I have any qualms about watching a baseball movie. I like it way more predictably for the feminism. Although, it's kind of bittersweet because, in actuality, this was a short-lived phenomenon. Women baseball players today probably are less likely to make a living as professional athletes than they were in the 40s, and there's kind of this frustrating truth hanging over. I felt a little bit the same way about Hidden Figures, which was a movie that I loved. It's hard to really cheer at the end when you know that their accomplishments, while far from meaningless, 60 years later, there's still massive institutional barriers to women and women of color in STEM fields or in baseball. But I'll wrap it all up by saying I still really enjoy the movie. It's fun to cheer for them. Great actors and good enough to spend 2 hours enjoying it.
Not as dour as last week's film, The Seventh Seal.
I love Seventh Seal. I will back that movie up classic. Way more. Yeah.
But from a dour standpoint, it is that.
I love dour films too, so.
This used to be my chess game. And I lost. And then death came for me and my friends. That's enough singing. All right, in 7 days, we do Easter right, because we're not going to get all serious about the murder of Jesus Cristo. Nope. Let's get funny and talk about Monty Python's Life of Brian. Brian. The Coming Attractions Trivia for The Life of Brian. This is an opinion thing, but I think I've said this in the podcast before. Which is my favorite member of Monty Python?
So, for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about The Life of Brian. And in Brian. The meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. Rate us and review us. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Mule!
Nag!
Don't make me cry, because there's no crying in podcasting.
And cut.